pull up a chair, because this one has everything. It has a scientist with an idea everyone said was physically impossible. It has a dam 200 feet tall sitting in a moonlit valley in Nazi Germany, surrounded by guns and nets and every defense the Third Reich could think to put there. It has 19 Lancaster bombers and 133 young men who had to fly 60 feet above the water, 60 feet in the dark at 232 miles per hour, to make that impossible idea work. This is the story of Operation Chastise, the Dam Busters raid, May the 16th into the 17th, 1943. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSold.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSold.com. Now, to understand why this raid happened, you have to go back to a drawing board somewhere in England, where a man named Barnes Wallace was staring at a problem that had defeated Royal Air Force planners for years. The Ruhr Valley, Germany's industrial heartland. The dams there, the Moni, the Eder, the Sorp, these weren't just concrete walls holding back water. They were the lifeblood of the Nazi war machine. They powered the steel mills. They supplied the water for industrial cities that made the tanks, the guns, the submarines. Every British planner knew that if you could knock those dams down, flood that valley, you could throw a serious wrench into German production at a critical moment in the war. Every British planner also knew it couldn't be done. The dams were too strong for conventional bombs dropped from altitude. Even if a bomber got lucky, the physics of blast propagation through water meant a conventional bomb detonating against the face of a dam just didn't transfer enough energy to crack it. And torpedoes, which might have gotten close enough to the base, couldn't penetrate because the Germans had strung anti-torpedo nets across the front of the reservoirs. The nets were there specifically because everyone, German and Allied alike, understood how valuable those dams were. Barnes Wallace didn't accept that answer. Wallace was an aeronautical engineer, and a genuinely remarkable one. He had designed the geodetic airframe structure for the Vickers Wellington bomber, an almost Basque-Kurtwerk design of interlocking aluminum alloy that gave the aircraft extraordinary strength and damage tolerance. The Wellington could absorb punishment that would have torn other bombers apart. The geodetic airframe was Wallace's brain at its best, solving a problem through geometry that other people solved through brute force. He applied the same thinking to the dam problem. His theory was this: the only way to breach a dam was to detonate an explosive right at its base underwater, where the pressure of the water above would multiply and direct the blast energy into the concrete. Not on top of the dam, not in the water in front of it. At the base, contact detonation, but at depth. The problem was getting the explosive there. His solution, and I want you to really hear this, was a rotating bomb that you dropped from low altitude and let skip across the water like a flat stone thrown by a kid on a riverbank. Yes, a bouncing bomb. The backspin, built in by rotating the weapon before release, would keep it stable during the skips. It would hop right over the torpedo nets. The forward momentum would carry it to the dam face. And then it would roll down the face of the dam, sinking to a depth of about 60 feet, before a hydrostatic fuse triggered the detonation, right at the base, right where Wallace needed it. His colleagues thought he'd lost his mind. The Air Ministry turned him down, then they turned him down again. The objections weren't unreasonable, the physics were largely theoretical, the manufacturing tolerances were absurdly tight, and even if the bomb worked exactly as designed, the aircraft delivering it would have to fly low and slow enough to be sitting ducks. Wallace kept going. He tested scale models in a water tank. He dropped marbles in a bathtub in his back garden and filmed them with a camera frame by frame, studying the skip dynamics. He went back to the Air Ministry with data, and eventually he had results that were hard to argue with. But here's where the numbers start getting genuinely uncomfortable to think about. For Wallace's upkeep mine, that was the official designation for it to work, the Lancaster delivering it had to be at exactly 60 feet above the water surface. Not 55. Not 65. 60. And it had to be flying at exactly 232 miles per hour. And the bomb had to be released at precisely 425 yards from the dam face. Every variable had to be dialed in within a very narrow margin. Too high, the bomb skips wrong. Too low, well, at 60 feet and 200 miles per hour over water at night. Too low isn't really a recoverable situation. Too fast or too slow, the skip geometry changes. Release too early or too late, the bomb ends up in the wrong place entirely. To solve the altitude problem, an engineer came up with one of the most elegantly simple instruments I have ever heard of. Two spotlights were mounted on each Lancaster, one under the nose, one under the tail, angled so that their beams converged at exactly 60 feet below the aircraft. When the pilot looked out and saw the two circles of light on the water merge into a single figure eight shape, he knew he was at 60 feet, not a radar altimeter, not a precision instrument. Two spotlights and trigonometry to solve the release point problem. The bomb aimer was given a wooden triangular sight, two nails driven through a piece of plywood at a calculated angle, calibrated to the known width between the towers on the dam face. When both towers lined up with the nails in the sight, he released a hand-carved piece of wood doing the work of a bomb sight. Primitive, precise, and happening at 60 feet off the deck at night, with people shooting at you. Now, the men who had to execute all of this didn't exist yet as a unit. The Air Ministry decided they needed a purpose-built squadron, assembled from scratch, drawn from the best crews in Bomber Command. They needed pilots and navigators and bomb aimers who were experienced enough to train for a mission they couldn't be told anything about. Not the target, not the weapon, not the reason for the low-level work they'd be drilling day after day. The man chosen to lead them was Wing Commander Guy Gibson. Gibson was 24 years old. Let that sit for a second. 24. He had already completed two full operational tours, one on bombers, one on night fighters. By any calculation, he had paid more than his due. He had been awarded the Distinguished Service Order with BAR, the Distinguished Flying Cross with BAR. He had flown 72 bombing missions over Germany, over 100 night fighter sorties. He was the kind of pilot you meet once in a lifetime, the kind where you can't quite put your finger on what makes him different, except that when things go wrong, he gets quieter and calmer instead of louder and faster. 617 Squadron Royal Air Force was formed in March of 1943. They had roughly 2 months to train. They trained over the lakes of Wales in northern England, flying at night, drilling those spotlights down to exactly 60 feet, running approach geometry over open water again and again until it became reflex. The rest of Bomber Command thought they'd gone round the bend. Nobody flew like this, nobody trained like this, and nobody was allowed to tell anyone why. The night before the operation, May the 15th going into the 16th, Gibson's black Labrador retriever, a dog named Nigger who had been his constant companion through the war and had become something of a mascot for the whole squadron, was struck and killed by a car just outside the base at Scampton. Gibson told his adjutant to keep it quiet until after the mission. He didn't want his crews going into the most dangerous night of their lives carrying that weight with them. He kept flying, he kept briefing, he kept every part of himself that was breaking buried under everything that still had work to do. That is what command costs. On the evening of May the 16th, 1943, 19 Avro Lancaster bombers took off from RAF Scampton in Lincolnshire. They flew in three waves, the first wave of 9 aircraft tasked with the Moni Dam and then the Eater. A second wave of 5 took a longer northern route toward the Sorp Dam. A third reserve wave of 5 would follow when called upon. They flew at treetop height across occupied Europe to avoid radar detection. And I want to be precise about what treetop height meant in practice. These are not figures of speech. Pilots and gunners in those aircraft talked about seeing individual branches going by in their peripheral vision, watching hedgerows and church steeples and power line towers flash past at over 200 miles per hour, with maybe 20 feet to spare. You pull up to a safe altitude, radar picks you up, and the flak starts. You stay at 50 feet, you're threading a needle for 400 miles through the dark. Two aircraft in the reserve wave were lost before they even reached Germany. One clipped a power line, shedding part of a wing. One flew into the sea at low altitude. 11 men, gone before the mission even began. Gibson reached the Mona Reservoir at around 20 minutes past midnight. The dam itself was almost intimidating to look at from the air. It was 600 yards wide, sitting at the narrower end of a long valley with hills rising on both sides. The approach run was constrained. You had to thread the valley, level out exactly right, and then fly directly at a wall of concrete 200 feet tall with gun emplacements on both towers and the surrounding ridgelines. Gibson made the first attack run himself. He came in at 60 feet. The spotlights formed that figure 8 on the water below him. His bomb aimer put the towers in the wooden sight. At 425 yards, the upkeep mine released, spun down, bounced across the surface, hit the dam, rolled under, detonated. The water column went up several hundred feet. The dam held, a second Lancaster attacked, a third. The dam held, a fourth Lancaster was badly damaged by the flak on the approach, one engine burning, barely clawing away from the reservoir. The dam held, a fifth run. The explosion, smoke and spray across the face of the dam. And then Gibson's crew, circling back around, saw the breach. Water, 330 million tons of it, was pushing through a gap in the Moni Dam and beginning its run down the valley. Gibson transmitted the code word for success. He had chosen it himself, the night before, when his dog was still alive, he said the word into the radio quiet and level and flew on to the eater. Here is the part of this story that I think about most. Gibson had already dropped his bomb. His mission, technically, was complete. He had the surviving aircraft from the first wave, badly depleted after the Moni attacks, to bring to the eater. He could have led them there professionally and then hung back at a safe distance while they worked. Instead, for every Lancaster that flew the eater attack run, Gibson flew alongside them, not above them, alongside, parallel to the attacking aircraft as they came across the water at 60 feet, firing his navigation lights to draw the flak guns his direction, talking the crews through on the radio. A man with nothing left to drop, choosing to make himself a target one more time for every crew that still had a bomb to deliver. The Eater Dam was breached on the third attempt. The floods were catastrophic. The Mona Valley was inundated from one end to the other within hours. Villages, farms, roads, rail lines, power stations. The wall of water reached towns 30 miles downstream. Power generation for the Ruhr was severely disrupted. Rail traffic to several industrial centers was knocked out. The flooding caused damage that took months to repair across dozens of facilities, and it's right to say out loud that approximately 1,294 people died in those floods, including more than 700 Soviet prisoners of war who were held in labor camps in the Mona Valley. The water that went through that breach did not stop to ask what uniform anyone was wearing. War is like that. The accounting never comes out clean. 8 of 19 Lancasters were lost, 53 of 133 aircrew killed, 3 captured. It was one of the highest single operation loss rates the Royal Air Force sustained in the entire war. The Germans repaired the Moni Dam within 5 months. By September of 1943, it was holding water again. That complicated legacy has followed Operation Chastise ever since. Was it worth it? 53 men, the flooding casualties, 5 months of disruption, real, significant, but not war-ending.
Barnes Wallace, when the casualty figures reached him, reportedly wept. He had pushed for this mission against institutional resistance for over a year. He believed in the strategy, believed in the weapon, believed it could help shorten the war. And then he sat with the final tally and understood what belief costs when it intersects with the real world. Gibson received the Victoria Cross, Britain's highest military honor. He wrote a memoir titled, Enemy Coast Ahead. He went back to operations when his commanders would rather have kept him grounded, leveraged him as a symbol, kept him safe. On the night of September the 19th, 1944, his de Havilland Mosquito failed to return from a mission over the Netherlands. He was 26 years old. The cause was never conclusively determined. Some fires burn the hottest and the shortest. What stays with me every time I come back to this story isn't the genius of the bouncing bomb or the cold precision of the approach geometry. It's the image of Guy Gibson, his upkeep already gone, circling back over the eater to fly alongside men who still had work to do. Not ordered to, not required to, just unwilling to leave. That's what separates a pilot from an aviator. The aircraft is the smallest part of it, primary sources. For today's segment include Gibson's own memoir and Paul Brickhill's The Dam Busters, along with historical research from the Royal Air Force Museum at Hendon and the Imperial War Museum in London. More stories at RadioHangar.com. I'm Tail Dragger. Fly low when the mission calls for it, but know what you're flying toward.